Accession number 22676, Reel 2.
Major Hutton, Reel 2. Was there any danger to the troops from going about by themselves, from being attacked by civilians?
There's no record of that at all. I don't think so.
I think you were just about to tell me about going into the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry.
Yes, I was gazetted as a regular officer into the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, and therefore was rather longing to serve with them and get to know them and be got to be known by them. Added to that, I read a book called The Jungle is Neutral by Spencer Chapman, which is about Spencer Chapman's experiences with Force 156, the parties that were left behind in Malaya in the jungle to act as guerrillas with the Chinese against the Japanese. And this is a fascinating book, actually, in great detail of his life in the jungle, and it rather fired me up to go and have those have that sort of experience myself in the Malayan jungle. So I pestered the posting authorities and eventually was allowed to be posted to my regiment in my new regiment, who were serving in Malaya at the time, in North Malaya, and I went there in January 1950, but unfortunately I wasn't there all that long. I was only there till October that year because I was due for what they called Python. Python was the great system in those days whereby if you'd been out of the UK, out of Europe, out of the UK and Europe for 3 years, you had to be posted home. Nobody could keep you. By October 1950, I was due for Python, and so I came home. But in that short time, from January to October, I did have quite a lot of experience infantry experience of operations against the bandits, as we call them then. Later, more politically correctly, they were known as communist terrorists, the CTs. We call them bandits. They were early days in the emergency. When I got there, the emergency had only been going on for 18 months. It started near Sungai Siput in January 1948. It's historically very well known. I think that this was a situation that was quite new to us, seeking out armed guerrilla bands in deep jungle. People who'd served in Burma, of course, very gallantly and in very, very harsh conditions against the Japanese, only a very few years before. Their jungle experience was called on, but of course this was a very different kind of operation to fighting a conventional war against a conventional enemy in Burma, because the Burmese jungle and the Malayan jungle are quite different. The Malayan jungle is mountainous, it's extremely thick, and on the fringes there are rubber estates, and the rubber estates, if they're not well managed, tend to be very overgrown as well. And the whole peninsula, about 400 miles long by 100 wide, provided ideal cover for armed guerrilla bands, and they were extremely hard to find. And if you did find them, they had ample time to possibly get a few shots off at you, kill or wound one or two soldiers, and run off, never to be seen again until the next contact. So it was the experience in Burma was not necessarily of enormous value. There were various schemes early on for hunting down these bands and destroying them. But they weren't very effective. Senior officers seemed to think, having possibly not spent much time in the jungle themselves, that you could do sort of partridge drives through sections of the jungle and flush them out. Well, this didn't work at all. The jungle was far too expansive and thick and impenetrable and very difficult to hack your way through. So that went on for, that type of operation went on for a year or two, but had very limited success. I was first of all, after a little small amount of training at the Batanins base in Penang, I was sent up to join A Company at a little town called Greek, which is right up in the north of Pera, a very long way from anywhere. I know that it was that the road from I think it was called Kuala Kangsar up to Greek was 65 miles of windy, narrow road, mainly through rubber plantations and rice fields and paddy fields and a little bit of virgin jungle, and it gradually wound its way up the Pera River Valley to Greek, and I joined the company there, and it was actually life in Malaya on company detachment was really rather a pleasant one, because you were away from battalion headquarters and there's people always love being away far from the next headquarters up as far away as they can, and so we led a good life in quite good accommodation, lovely climate, hot, but very pleasant, and the excitement of going out on armed patrols, trying to track these bandits down. And the way we did it in those days was pretty hit or miss. The local police, who were British officered, were the source of information. They were the sort of intelligence arm who were informers, would give information on the whereabouts of bandits in their camps, and this information would come through to us, and usually the information could be anything up to a week late. So the situation that had been reported or the movement that had been reported had long since ceased. Nevertheless, we would go out and look for it. Also information on where their camps were. You would get to the camp and find it had been abandoned. So there was a great deal of walking about the jungle and not finding very much. And if one made a contact with bandits, it was either through very astute planning or luck. But the only way to achieve a lot of kills, as we call them, was to surround the gang. Well, that is in thick jungle. It's very difficult to surround anybody without being heard. So the occasions when there were an appreciable number of kills achieved were again very few. In fact, during the time my regiment was there, from January 48 until they left, and I'd left them by then, in 1951, they killed just under 60 bandits. Now that might sound very few for about two and a half years' work, but of course they lost men as well from time to time, sadly.
Which company and platoon were you with?
I was with A Company. I forget the number of the platoon. The most interesting experience I had was a very sad day. We moved about. I said we were at Greek when I first went up there. We then moved to a little town called Kulim, which was an absolute hotbed of the communist leanings of the Chinese, who were leaning towards a communist insurrection. I haven't mentioned Malays because the Malays, in fact, didn't take much part in the whole emergency. There was a regiment of Malays who were used in several battalions, who were used in counterinsurgency operations, but the Chinese were the cause of the emergency, because the insurrection was Chinese based. And Kulim was, I think, had a lot of Chinese there, and I think that the Kulim area was one they had hoped to get under completely under communist control, and a sort of no-go area for troops or police, but they never achieved this. After Kulim, we were sent up to a place called Kro. Kro is within a very few miles of the Siamese or Thai border. And a few miles along the border, still within Malaya, was a small mining town called Klianintan. And the Crow Company would keep a platoon at Klianintan, and the miners, a mining community again, were pretty communist. So between Klianintan and Crow was several miles of narrow winding road through jungle. And some of it fairly precipitous. So the resupply convoys used to be shot at by insurgents from the side of the road at intervals. It was quite a feature of life up there. But the most interesting experience I had at Crow was one unfortunate weekend. My company commander was away down to see his wife in Penang, there was a report that a jungle squad of Malay police, led by a British officer, had been badly shot up entering Thailand. Now, I say entering Thailand, and this may sound rather odd, but the bandits were known to have camps and rest areas within Thailand, of which the Thais did very little about. We, of course, asked if we could get at them. They said, well, we can't. Political reasons, we can't accept troops patrolling into Thailand, but you may send police patrols. And of course, police patrols were very much like an army patrol. They were fully armed, like machine guns and so on and so forth, led by a British officer, whom I knew personally, a man called Pat Evans. I took a platoon. It was guided in along the route the police patrol had followed, and with a guide who had been part of the patrol and had seen what had gone on, had escaped because it had been very badly shot up, and some men had escaped. He told me where the bandits. He then showed me where the bandits were, and we put in an attack on it. And the bandits had gone as usual, but we then had the very unhappy job of clearing the battlefield and picking up the body of a friend, Pat Evans, which was very sad for me, and carried them to the nearest road within Thailand, where the Thais provided transport. The Thai police provided transport, which was then taken into the nearest town, which was Betong. The bodies of these Malay policemen and with their British officer, and when we arrived in Betong, we found the streets were lined with police, and the district officer, who was a self-styled prince, known to us socially, actually, he was rather embarrassed by the whole thing. And they presented arms when the bodies were transferred from Thai police transport to British Army transport, which was sent over. That, in fact, was the end of that story, it was the one time we didn't ask permission. We actually took an army patrol into Thailand and would have taken offensive action against any bandits that we'd found, but in the end that came to nothing.
Did you retrieve any wounded?
Yes, there were wounded. In fact, the wounded were taken back along the way they'd come in. Everybody there was dead, because what the bandits used to do when they'd had a successful ambush was that they would go and finish off the wounded and steal their weapons and their watches and anything else they wanted. So only wounded who could escape on foot would get away, and actually they got away along the footpaths, the jungle paths, back to Kro through the jungle, and not the way we went.
Had any casualties been inflicted on the enemy?
None at all, on that occasion. Not that we know of.
Any other incidents you remember?
None of my personal experience. There were plenty of incidents with contacts with bandits where there were casualties on both sides. Fleeting, these actions were always very fleeting. A few quick shots, and one or two killed or wounded, and then the bandits would go. The bandits never stood up and fought. They never stood and fought.
Did you capture any material from the enemy?
Oh yes. If you did a successful contact on a bandit camp, where possibly you would inflict very few casualties on them, but they would flee their camp possibly in a hurry, then one would get quite a lot of their material in the way of weapons and written material, and so on and so forth, which might be of value to the intelligence.
Can you remember anything specifically?
I can't know, not at that time. Much has been recorded of the later stage of the emergency where we got very much better, because remember that we won. It's guerrilla wars are very rarely won by the internal security power. It's usually the guerrillas come out in the end and get what they want, but eventually this didn't happen in Malaya, and I think it is the one situation, where the only situation in the sort of second half of the 20th century where a guerrilla war was won by the internal security powers. Mind you, it took us 8 years to do it, and a very strict regime by Gerald Templer of controlling the civilian population so that the bandit source of food supply was cut off, and very, very much more rigorous and well-organized military action, where jungle forts were set up so that we actually controlled areas of the jungle from within the jungle instead of outside it. Much more effective ambushing of known bandit movement routes and so on and so forth. That's what eventually won the emergency.
Was your unit used in that kind of duty?
We certainly performed ambushes but we never actually set up a jungle fort. This was later. The measures I'm talking about were later, after my regiment left. My regiment left Malaya in 1951 and went to Germany.
Did you meet any VIPs in Malaya?
Not at that time. I can't remember that I did, actually. I can't remember that I did.
Did you have national servicemen in your company?
Oh, at that time, very many. Very many. It was only a year or two since the release groups from the war had actually left. National service came in about 1948, so we had a great many national servicemen in the army at that time. Great many.
How did they perform?
Oh, very well. National servicemen, they were the backbone of the army, really, for about 12 years. They performed very well. And national service officers as well.
So during 1950, you were entirely in the Greek and Crow area?
Not entirely, no, because we moved, we spent a few weeks at a hotbed of communist activity called Sungai Siput. And Sungai Siput was where the emergency started. And we expected there to have a lot of perhaps quite see some action, but it were very, very hard to pin down, because our camp was on the playing fields, the edge of the playing fields in Sungai Siput, and if we left for an operation, information of where we'd gone would very soon get to the bandits probably, so Unfortunately, we had very little success there.
What did your soldiers think of serving in Malaya?
Hard work, very hard work, but in the usual way of the British soldier, they were uncomplaining, humorous, and put up with it all. They did regret the loss of some of their friends, because there were men killed from time to time.
What was your own attitude towards the enemy?
Oh, very hostile. Very hostile, because they performed terrorist acts. They had to terrorize the civilian population in order to get food supplies and so on. One was contemptuous of them, that they wouldn't stand and fight. But the initial action against them was usually on their terms, because they knew you were coming, and therefore could fire the first shot at you and then run off. So one had a fairly contemptuous view of their fighting skills, although one had a certain admiration for them hiding up in the jungle and living the life they did. They were very hardy people. And one had read a lot about them from the inside and from Spencer Chapman's book.
Did you ever capture any of them or get any defectors?
Yes, the battalion did, certainly. And they were very useful, although they were supposed then to be able to lead one to where the bandits were. But of course they were very nervous of creating successful action against their former comrades, because if they were it might come back to them when they were released, they might get they do pretty nasty things to each other in the way of torture and slow lingering deaths and so on and so forth. Chinese are quite good at that. So defectors and informers were extremely useful, and in fact it's how the intelligence picture of bandit movements was built up.
What did you think of the performance of the Malayan police?
Thinking back a long time, I don't think that we were critical. We had criticisms of them. I think that they were doing as good a job as they could in the circumstances, and they lived in a certain amount of danger themselves. The officers were very dedicated, both the British and native officers, very dedicated.
And the Malayan administration.
Well, remember that it was Malaya was then. It was under British colonial rule, although the states had a certain amount of independence in their own government, within their own government, and they had sultans, and there was even a king of Malaya, I think. Malays are sleepy. The Chinese had very little part in the administration of the country, although the Chinese population of Malaya is almost as high as a Malay. They were almost entirely in commerce and labour on the tin mines, rubber estates, and in commerce.
What were relations like between the British Army units and the British administration in Malaya?
Oh, hand in glove, very good.
You said you left in October of this year, 1950. Mm. Can you tell me about that, please?
I left on Python, on the Python arrangement, and then I had a lot of leave. Going back some way now, when I went out to the BCLI in Cyprus in late 1947, I went through Haifa, and Haifa was the headquarters of 6th Airborne Division, commanded by General Sir Hugh Stockwell. And General Sir Hugh Stockwell had been an old friend of my father's, and so I rang up the ADC and said, could I call on the general? And he rang back, and he had a word with the general, and he said, John, you're to come and stay. So my short wait in Haifa for the ship over to Famagusta was a very pleasant one, going round with General Sir Hugh Stockwell, who was a very boyish general. He was great fun, very well known. He later commanded the ill-fated Suez operation in 1956. And he said, this is everything an ambitious young officer should do. He should do a secondment to the parachute regiment. So I volunteered for that. And in January 51, I went to the Airborne Forces Depot for the initiation tests into the parachute regiment, which were fairly strenuous, to say the least. And then another part of my service opened up.
In what way was it so strenuous?
Well, I think everybody's heard of P Company, which is still going on at Aldershot, which is where the initiation tests that last a fortnight for anybody wanting to join a parachute battalion. It's mostly a test of physical stamina and mental, and the mental stamina required to back up the physical test and hard work. I'm not ashamed to say that I failed the first one, normally if you fail it, you're sent away. But I think that that for some reason or other, they must have thought that I was worth pursuing, so to speak, and I was given another go and passed.
So P Company is the training company?
P Company is the testing company. Mm. The testing company for recruits. In those days, there were no direct recruits into the parachute regiment in any way. They were all volunteers from other regiments. And the P Company was the testing company of Aldershot, but the 16th Parachute Brigade was different, was separate. It had its three service battalions, 1st, 2nd and 3rd in those days. Still exist, of course, although I don't think there are three battalions anymore. So in March or April 51, I joined the 3rd Parachute Battalion in Aldershot. And having thought I was going to get a nice spell of home service, after a short time, the Parachute Brigade was warned for possible operations in Abadan to re-secure the Anglo-Iranian oil company's installations, which had been nationalized by Mossadegh, who was Prime Minister of Iran at the time. So we were sent out to Cyprus in two aircraft carriers, the Triumph and the Warrior, the whole parachute brigade. And but when we got to Cyprus, we obviously didn't have the political will in those days. I think it was probably the very first incident where the lion's tail was twisted and the lion didn't react. And it was a trigger for everybody to try and twist the lion's tail all over the world. And no action was taken against Mossadegh for nationalising what in fact was British property. The Parachute Brigade was left in Cyprus, training hard in very hot weather. Most enjoyable there. I had a great regiment to serve in. I did a 3-year secondment, which was the term in those days. You could extend it, but for 3 years you were entirely the property of the parachute regiment. You couldn't go off and do anything else, which was rather a pity because General Stockwell, I mentioned earlier, he asked for me to go to Malaya as his ADC when he was just taking up the job of GOC Malaya, and I'd love to have gone. But the brigade commander said, no, General Huey, General Sir Huey, I'm afraid that John Hutton is bespoke to the parachute regiment for 3 years, and you can't have him. So so I stayed where I was. But after a few months in Cyprus, most of the troops in Cyprus were sent to Egypt, because the King Farouk had nationalized the Suez Canal, and we thought that Farouk nationalized it, and it was, but Farouk was then deposed, and Naguib took over.